As we study through this book of Ecclesiastes, you have to keep in mind all the way through the book that Solomon's perspective is on the visible, not on the invisible. And Solomon is focusing on the audible, not on the inaudible. He has a physical focus, not a spiritual focus throughout the book. In fact, 29 times, I believe, he talks about existence under the sun. Doesn't mention anything about above the sun. He just talks about life on this plane. And remember, it's written from the perspective of a man who had it all. Probably the wealthiest man, single individual, the world has ever seen. The wisest man that ever lived. And it's his perspective of the futility of life without Jesus, and life apart from Christ without any exaggeration. You know, he comes out with the things that maybe often slide through your heart or your mind that you don't say as you struggle, and you wonder where the Lord is, and you wonder sometimes what life is all about, and if he loves me, why does hardship come, and why am I struggling? You know, he's a guy who gives you a perspective straight across the board, no messing around, what life's all about without God in focus. Now, I'm assuming, right off the bat, by the way, that this is written by Solomon. For a number of years, scholarship said, well, it's after the exile by some of the grammar and so forth. But the later scholarship has agreed that in Canaanite writings and so forth, what I'm trying to say is the focus is back on Solomon. I don't think there's any doubt, at least in my mind, that this is the son of David, Solomon. It says, who was the greatest, wisest, richest king that Israel ever saw. He identifies himself clearly as we go into this. Remember, let's turn to 1 Kings chapter 11, just for kind of a little background as we look at the end of the man's life. You know, it's a wonder when you study through the book of Proverbs, that the guy transgressed everything he wrote. About women, about wine, about foolishness, about adultery, about idolatry, about wisdom. It's amazing that he learned a lot of this from David, his father. David was the one who said, look, as you grow up, don't despise the chastening of the Lord. I know all about it. Take it from me, you know. And remarkable, the things that he had learned from David. Put them in perspective, categorized them, understood instruction, wisdom, wrote them down, and yet transgressed all of those very things himself. And to me, it's one of the big differences between Solomon and David in that David, in the midst of his depression, in the midst of his hardship, he would always rise up to the truth again. As you read the Psalms that he wrote as he was in the cave of Adullam, you know, he had slain the giant, and all it really got him was aggravation from Saul and envy and jealousy, and he was driven away, and one by one God stripped every important person and every meaningful thing out of his life, and for all of his faith and all of his trust in God, he ended up with nothing, driven alone to where he finally was slobbering down his beard, acting like a madman to leave the Philistine city, and went and sat in a cave alone, and there, of course, he rises and says, one thing have I desired of the Lord, and that will I seek after, that I might dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, that I might behold his beauty and seek him in his temple. You know, he's the kind of guy that if you read through the Psalms, he goes way down, but he always rebounds in the worst of circumstances. He realizes, well, if I die, you know, what's the worst that can happen? I mean, it can all end here, but he has made known unto me the paths of life. You know, David would always rebound in his heart to the truth that there was life after, and that he was looking forward to coming into the courts of the king and gazing at his beauty and inquiring in his temple. And Solomon seems to get into his depression and just get stuck in the mud there and stay there for all of his wisdom. And interesting, as we look in 1 Kings chapter 11 here, it says, King Solomon loved many strange women. Together with the daughter of Pharaoh, He loved women of Moab and Ammon and Edom and Zidon and the Hittites and of the nations concerning which the Lord said unto the children of Israel, you shall not go into them, neither shall they come into you, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. But Solomon clave to these in love, and he had 700 wives and 300 concubines. That's all you can say, isn't it? And his wives turned away his heart. For it came to pass when Solomon was old that his wives turned away his heart after other gods. His heart was not perfect with the Lord his God. Notice, as was the heart of David his father. Now, you know, here's the thing with Solomon. His heart turned away from the living God. The remarkable thing about David and his heart was perfect towards God in this, that when he fell before the God that he believed in. When he sinned before the God he believed in. When he committed adultery or murder, when he made a mess of his life, it was before his God. He never went and became a Buddhist when he got depressed, or a Hare Krishna or something. Whereas Solomon, with all his wisdom, began to worship other gods and his heart was drawn away. David, in all of his failure, never found another God. He knew there was one true God who loved him, and he always went back to him and said, man, here I am again. I blew it big time again. You know, can you forgive me again? My bones are dried up within me, and my sin is eating away at me, and I have got no peace, and I'm coming to confess my sin and so forth. You know, it's like Peter, when the Lord said, Peter, Satan hath desired to sift you as wheat, but I prayed for you that your faith wouldn't fail. Now, when you're restored, comfort your brethren, you know. And the idea was, Peter denied Jesus. He ran out in the darkness, weeping and so forth. But his faith didn't fail in Jesus' own estimation. The idea was, Peter didn't go out and find another God. He didn't say, Jesus, this stinks. I'm going to, you know, I'll become a Baha'i. You know, there's centers up in Haifa, and it's not too far. Or something like that. He knew that he blew it, and he turned his back on the one true God, his Lord. You know, he knew that he denied his Lord. He never turned away his heart from the fact that Christ was the way, the truth, and the life. And David didn't either, though he blew it, though he was weak, though he was human. And that's why we always see him rising again, even in the midst of his problems. As bad as things got, his heart was there, back to God. Whereas Solomon, because he turned away and worshipped other gods, we really see him get in the muck and in the mire of life. And here, you know, we see him turning away from the very things God told him not to turn away from. And look in verse 11, chapter 11 there. Wherefore the Lord said unto Solomon, for as much as this is done of thee, thou hast not kept my covenant, my statutes, which I have commanded thee, I will surely tear the kingdom from thee, and I will give it to thy servant. So we see the degeneration of Solomon, and it didn't come quickly. It was a slow process. Degeneration never happens quickly. Nehemiah in chapter 13 says, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Again, the children of Israel then were marrying unbelievers. Yet among many nations was there no king like him, who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nonetheless, even him did outlandish women cause to sin. Shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil and transgress against the Lord our God, marrying strange wives? So even in Nehemiah's time, he says, look back to Solomon, the wisest man that ever lived. So as we come to this book of Ecclesiastes, we're kind of like in a mid-life crisis of Solomon, towards the end of his life, a mid-reign crisis or something, I don't know. To where he's got all the wisdom the world has. He understands all the things that are around him. There's nobody even smart enough to talk to him. He understands more than anybody else. He's got all the money. He's got 700 wives and 300 concubines. He's got fish ponds. He's got trees. He's got everything. And he's sitting around going, you know, everything is vanity. What's the sense in the whole spiel? What's the point of life? And you have to keep that in mind, because that's his frustration and his vexation as he goes through this. I got it all, and it doesn't mean anything. And I hope the thing that we can learn from it as we go through is there's probably a lot of things that Solomon has in this book that we think if we got, we'd be happier. And we can take it from him ahead of time, if we're smart, that it doesn't satisfy. It's nice, but it's not what we're looking for. He begins in Ecclesiastes. You know, it's like the point is life is pointless, or the meaning of life is that it's meaningless, or, you know, that's where he ends up. The words of the preacher, or teacher, NIV, I think, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, here's the theme of his writing, vanity of vanities, saith the preacher, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Sounds like Eeyore wrote this, doesn't it? Emptiness is the idea of vanities. It's emptiness. It's not vain like we understand vainness today. It's emptiness. There's nothing there. You know, what's meaninglessness, I think the NIV says. What profit has a man of all his labor? And the word labor, I think, is in the book 34 times. Of all his labor which he takes under the sun. And there's his perspective. Under the sun. 29 times in the book, he talks about life under the sun. And whether it's religion under the sun, or marriage under the sun, or pleasure under the sun, or wealth under the sun, life under the sun with no more than that, you might as well be a beast. You know, there's people that are millionaires who die, and in their will, they leave their estate and their millions to their cat. You know, you might as well be that cat and eat the best tabby that's ever been canned for the rest of your life, you know, and sleep on a stuffed bed or something, if all your life is existence under the sun. And some of you can remember that. I can remember before I was saved thinking, you know, God, if you're really there, what's the purpose in all this? You might as well have made me an ox, because I can eat and I can sweat and I can work and I can go to the bathroom and I can breathe. I can do all the things an ox does, but what in the world is life all about? And Solomon at this point, that's what he's saying. He's looking like vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And what profit, what advantage has any man in all of his labor that he takes in this world under the sun? And now he starts to look at the circular part of life. Listen to some of these. They're amazing. One generation passes away, and another generation comes. But the earth abides forever. I get a feeling that he's standing in the middle at this point, looking at maybe Rehoboam growing up. David has passed off the scene, and he's kind of that midlife crisis where, man, I'm getting old. I can't do the things I used to. I got everything I thought I wanted. One generation's dying, another generation's coming up behind me, and I'm in the middle of the... I'm getting shoved out of the picture by the one coming up behind me. He's looking at the monotony of life. The sun, he says, also rises, and... the sun goes down. He's been watching this for a long time. And it hastens to his place where he arose, or he panteth. He sees the sun panting to get back to, I'm glad that I'm not the only one that does that, you know. You know, there's not enough time in the day, he says. The sun comes up, it goes down, and then here comes the sun over the horizon again to go around once more, panting back to his place, you know. There's just not enough time in a day. The wind goes towards the south, and it turneth about to the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. Now, because of satellite photography with the news now, we've had the advantage to see that. As you look down at the earth, you can see the big swirls and the wind. Some of these things are pretty remarkable that Solomon wrote about them, the hydro systems and so forth, way back in his day. With all the knowledge and understanding he has, he says, man, everything just going around, you know what I mean? And it's circuits and in their orbits. He says the wind goes to the south and it comes back again. The sun goes up, it comes down. One generation comes, it passes away, another one comes up behind it. What in the world is going on? All the rivers, he says, run into the sea, yet the sea is not full, and unto the place from whence the rivers came, thither they return again. So he said they're just running back to the ocean, to the place where they evaporated in the first place and came from. They just run back again. And he sees this cycle and everything, you know. And with all of his wisdom, as he looks at the hydro systems, as he looks at the weather patterns, as he looks at the earth on its axis, as he looks at the sun rising and setting, one generation coming, he says, here I am with all these brains, all this wealth, everything. I'm sitting here watching the whole thing go round and round like a big clock that somebody wound up. And I'm just getting older and passing out of the scene. And I'm wondering, you know, really, what does man have? What advantage does he have in all of his labor under the sun? What is life all about? All things are full of labor, he says. My life is full of monotony. Man cannot utter. He can't even explain it. The eye, he said, is not satisfied with seeing. You look at everything around you. You look at the most beautiful thing you ever saw. You look at the most amazing thing you ever saw. Then you said, oh, I got to have somebody here to see it with me. Or you see one movie and you tell your friend, did you see this movie? This is really the best movie I ever saw. And of course, in 2 months you saw another best movie you ever saw. And you get tired of looking what's around, you get a microscope. And you get bored with little things, you get a telescope. You look at big things, you know. And then you look at pornography and that doesn't make any desire go away. And the eye's never filled with seeing. The ear, he said, it's never filled with hearing. You hear gossip? Hey, did you hear? Huh? You know, and you're just as anxious to hear it again. The ear is never filled with hearing, whether it's music or gossip or someone praising you. He says, the eye gate, the ear gate, they're insatiable. The thing that hath been is the thing that shall be. And that which is done is that which shall be done. And there is no new thing under the sun. I mean, what a perspective, you know. You keep your bell bottoms long enough and they're going to come back in style. You know, that's what he's saying. That which has been done, you know, there ain't nothing new. It's going to happen again. I've got a book that National Geographic put out on Egypt, ancient Egypt, and the culture there. And there's part of it that says that the most popular drink amongst the Egyptians was beer. That every pharaoh had his own brewmaster, and it wasn't wine, it was beer, and they would drink it warm, of course. But the whole nation was into beer. And in one of the hieroglyphics, they found a professor from a university wrote, "My students are good for nothing. All they do is carouse and drink beer." And I thought, there's nothing new under the sun. I mean, you know, things have not changed at all. Nations rise, nations fall, history repeats itself, and all man learns from history that he doesn't learn from history. You know, that's what worries me about atomic bombs. We've never made weapons we haven't used, you know. What has been is what's going to be. I mean, you know, is there anything whereof it may be said, see this thing? It's new. It's already been of old time that was before us. The idea is everybody who knew about it died, so when we discover it again, it seems new. It's already been here. There is no remembrance of former things. Neither shall there be any remembrance of things that are yet to come with those that shall come after them. Now, what a depressing view, you know. Great men pass away and you remember them for a little while and then they die off. And, you know, if you live to be 100 and your kids die before you, and when you die, nobody comes to your funeral because everybody knew you was already gone, you know. The time comes and it goes and... He's looking at the rotations of life and the patterns and saying, what in the world? It's just going around and around and around. And what is it all worth to man who comes into this existence and lives his few short years and then passes out again? I, the preacher, was king over Israel in Jerusalem. And I gave my heart to seek. That's the idea, is to seek and to understand and to search out or to explore by experience wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. So it's a time of peace. Remember, his kingdom was established in peace. He's not worrying about war and how to set his battlements in array and so forth. He's sitting around on his throne. He doesn't have to defeat any enemies. And he says, I gave myself to seek out, to understand, and to explore, to experiment with all the wisdom that men understand under the sun. And you have to understand, this guy's got the resources. He's got all the brains to understand anything he might probe into, and he's got all the finances to pay for any of his experiments. He doesn't need to be funded by anybody. So he's in a dangerous position when a guy like this is bored. And he says, so I gave myself to seek and search out wisdom concerning all the things that are done under heaven. And he says, this is sore travail that God has given unto the sons of man to be exercised. God has laid a heavy trip on us, he says. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun. And behold, all is vanity and vexation of spirit. Everything is emptiness, vexation of your spirit. Your Bible might say chasing after wind. I think that's frustration. Chasing after wind would always be frustration to me. So everything is emptiness and frustration, he says, as I look around in life. The Latin frustra means vain. And so he says, I look around and everything in life is meaningless and frustrating. What a sad state to be in. That which is crooked cannot be made straight. Now, the Greek philosopher said this same thing. And that which is wanting cannot be numbered. There's so many things wrong and lacking in this world, you can't even count them as you begin to look around. And the things that are wrong, how can you ever make them right? The thing that is crooked cannot be made straight. Now, that is apart from Jesus, of course. Because most of us in this room were crooked, and he made us straight. We were crooked literally, we were crooked mentally, we were crooked spiritually. Our lives were crooked, and he made us straight. But Solomon, as you look around, of course, this is not within the realm of his examination. I communed with my own heart, because there was nobody else smart enough to talk to, I guess, saying, lo, I am come to great estate, and I've gotten more wisdom than all they that have been before me in Jerusalem. Yea, my heart hath great experience of wisdom and of knowledge. And I gave my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive this also is frustration. Now, of course, remember, this is without Christ. And isn't it remarkable? Here's Solomon sitting on top of the world, as it were, with everything that you and I might desire. And in that place, he's completely frustrated and coming apart. David, under all the pressure, the pursuit of Saul, his life falling apart, the family problems, was a guy who always reached out and took hold of God's, you know, skirt, as it were. He took a hold of the Lord. And in all of his problems, he had way more to himself. There was way more of a man there. There was way more substance in David's life with all of his hardship and suffering than there is here in the life of Solomon with everything that he's got going for him. Sad as we look at it. He says in verse 18, for in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increases knowledge increases sorrow. The more I know, the more bummed out I get, he said. The more I realize, the more misery I see in this world. The more I understand, the more suffering I see there is. And I'm left asking why. And that's bad for us, if it's true, because this is the information age, you know. When we watched the war in the Persian Gulf, we saw something that no other generation ever saw. Vietnam was not covered like that, or the Korean War, World War I, or World War II. I mean, for the first 4 or 5 days, I was so glued to the television set, I had to take vitamin B's. I mean, I was drained. I was spaced out. I mean, I couldn't pull myself away from it, you know. And he says, with much knowledge is depression, is sadness. The more you know, the more sorrow is increased. Now, again, this is in the material world. The more I know about Jesus, the happier I am. The more I understand about those streets of gold and those walls of jewels, the more my heart is lifted up. The more I understand about the sorrow in the world and the suffering and the earthquakes and the famine and the wars in light of what he said, the more excited I am that he's coming at any moment. You see, and there's quite a difference. Solomon is looking at everything on this level, in and of itself, under the sun. Now, he says, I said in my heart, come on now, I'm going to try. I'll prove thee by mirth and enjoyment of pleasure. He says, I sought knowledge and wisdom. That was a bummer. And I looked at the natural existence, traveling in his circuits, and the wind, and the planet, and man, and generation, and that was a bummer. I think I'll party now. You know, I think I'll try to drown my sorrows. I'll experiment with wine and pleasure and joy, and maybe that's what I'm looking for. Typical, of course. I said in my own heart. Now, he's got to find somebody else to take counsel with, by the way, as we're going through this. I will prove thee with mirth, prove his own heart with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure And behold, this also is emptiness. I said of laughter, it's nothing but madness. And of pleasure, what does it accomplish? I sought in my heart to give myself unto wine. Yet, acquainting my heart with wisdom. Sure, Solomon. You know, what he's saying is I decided to experiment with wine, but do it as a scientist, you know. Let's see, 1243, you know, yeah, feeling pretty good, but oh man, I'm frustrated, this is a bummer, you know. Come on, Solomon, cut us a break, you know. He's seeking to experiment with wine, and yet he says, with wisdom in his heart, and to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was it was good for in the sons of men, which they should do under heaven all the days of their life. And I like this. The Hebrew says the number of days of their life. I think as we if we would think more of our life in the realm of numbers of days instead of years, it gives a little more urgency. You know, when you figure your life is numbered by days, you think, gee, it's one less, you know. You got to wait a long time for a year to go by to say, gee, one less year, you know. But when you start realizing your life, according to God, is numbered in days, you can put a little more urgency in your life. And he's now seeking through pleasure and folly and madness to see what good there might be for men whose days are numbered as they exist under the sun. And pleasure, you know, pleasure promises a lot to us but delivers little. Again, Donald Trump was asked about, you know, why with all your money and why with everything you have, why do you still push onward? And he said, it's the pursuit. You know, it's the pursuit. It's not the acquiescing, it's not the act, it's the pursuit. Somehow the excitement, I think, is in the pursuit of these things and not in the having of them. You know, and there's some bait, you know, that kind of hangs out before us in regards to pleasure. And we think, if I could have this, I'd be fulfilled. If I could have that, I'd be... And it seems like the enjoyment, we're so sick, is really in the pursuit. Once we get it, it's never what we think it'll be. Because pleasure makes a lot of great promises, but it delivers very little. And it's short-lived. So I made great works. Now he's going on to... I'm going to accomplish things. You know, I've looked at the world rotating. I've tried knowledge and understanding. That was really a bummer. Then I gave myself to pleasure and folly and madness, and that was stupid and empty. And now I'm going to accomplish something. You know, great accomplishments. Maybe you're a workaholic or an accomplisher here tonight. You know, if you're given the pleasure, I get news for you. Don't listen to Dr. Ruth or... or Sigmund Freud or Hugh Hefner, because Solomon knew more about physical pleasure than any of these people. He made them look like kindergartners in regards to knowledge of pleasure. He had 700 wives and 300 concubines. What's a concubine? It's a woman that's just for pleasure, just for physical pleasure. It's just she's there to meet your sexual desires. So, in fact, in Rome in Paul's day, I think they said every man should have a wife to bear his legitimate children, a mistress to enjoy life with, and a concubine to have pleasure with. You know, women really came to the right place that was always in God's heart after Christ came and began to enter into the hearts of mankind. Women really took on their place then. When we talk about women's rights, there's nobody who's given more than God. But 700 wives, 300 concubines, you don't need to hear from Howard, from Dr. Ruth or any of these other people. Believe Solomon as we read through this. Now I made great works, he said. Now, from verse 4 on to about verse 11, you'd be amazed if you underline every time he says, I, me, or my. I mean, he's really focused on his own life here. I made great works. I builded me houses. I planted me vineyards. I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees of all sorts. I could get into this, by the way. I'd love to have just a big park with maybe a bunch of 50-foot loose-leaf Japanese maples and real nice bent grass from putting greens and a stream running through it. I could really design something where I could go and space out, but you probably get tired of it after a few days. And Solomon got into the whole scene here. I made me pools of water to water the trees that I planted. Now, first he made great houses. Then he decided there needed to be trees around them. Then he planted trees around them. Then he decided he wanted fruit. Then he realized he needed water for the trees he planted around his houses. So now he made pools to water the trees. And then I got me servants. You need somebody to pick the fruit, obviously. I got me servants, maid servants, men servants, and even servants born in my own house. And I had great possessions of great and small cattle. He became a cattle baron above all that were in Jerusalem before me. And he says, I began to gather. He began to collect. Some of us are collectors. We think the more we collect, the happier we'll be. Solomon collected more than you're ever going to collect, and he's going to tell you it was vanity. You know, some of us collect music boxes, or we collect this or collect that. Some of us are hamsters by nature, I think. I gathered now. He begins to gather silver and gold and peculiar treasure of kings and of the provinces. And then I got men singers and women singers. He had bands, live bands come in the house while he was drinking and looking at his trees. And I mean, he indulged himself. And women singers and the delights of the sons of men. Some of your translations there will say that his harem and his concubines, his wives, is speaking of the delights of the sons of men. And musical instruments, those of all sorts. So he's pursuing everything that this life might offer, you know, on this level. And it doesn't fulfill. You know, it's interesting that I went to the concert up at Trenton the other night with the kids and saw some rappers and stuff. And my ears bled for a day and a half afterwards. I was amazed, you know, the energy. I mean, it was great. The kids loved it. And the one band is on the road 210 days. They do 210 dates a year on the road. And I was looking at them, jumping around a stage, banging. I get tired. I have a heart attack doing what they do, you know. And the drums were going upside down, and the guy was, you know, upside down smoke machines. And I'm thinking, 210 days a year, you know. And they're where a lot of people think they want to be, you know. Now, of course, they do it because they have a purpose. The guy on the drums going around, if he has a heart attack, he's going to heaven. You know, he's there doing it for Christ. I mean, there's a purpose. It's not just under the sun. But I think, look at all those stations in life that we admire. If I could be a movie star, if I could be a successful car salesman, if I could be a land baron, if I could be a rock star, you know. And then you see all those people, a sports figure that arrive in those places. How many of them become drug addicts and get divorced and commit suicide and their life falls apart? Because they're saying what Solomon says. You know, I've done it all. I've arrived. And what is there? There's nothing to it. It's emptiness. I've got what I always thought I wanted. It isn't what I wanted all along. I'm miserable. What's life all about? And that's what he's saying here. But, you know, he had his own breweries, his own wine, his own 1,000 women at his disposal for every pleasure he could dream of. He brought rock bands into his own living room. He didn't have to go to a concert. He just had them at home. You know, fruit trees, vineyards, everything that anybody could ever dream of. And I was great, verse 9. And I was increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. That's debatable at this point. And whatsoever my eye desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and this was my portion in all my labor. So imagine this. He said it was an era in his life when I didn't withhold myself from any desire, my flesh or my heart had in all of life. I could afford everything. Everything was available to me. I mean, take a lesson from this. Because some of you are still pursuing the wind. It's vexation of spirit. It's frustrating. You're still pursuing something you think that if you had, would fulfill your life. And you're fooling yourself. And sometimes Satan just hangs that carrot out in front of us, you know, that bait. And he causes us to lose focus on what life is really all about. He said, this was my portion, and all that I had. And look at verse 11. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had wrought, and on all the labor that I had labored to do. Behold, it was all emptiness and frustration, vexation of spirit. And there was no profit under the sun. You know, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his soul, Jesus would say. He said, I looked at everything. What was it all worth? He says. Now, verse 12, he begins to turn again in another direction, and he says he's going to start comparing things. He's thinking perhaps if I compare light with darkness, good with evil, folly with wisdom, you know, that he's going to discover something. So now comparison begins to come into his pursuit, into his quest. And I turn myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly. For what can a man do that cometh after the king? Even that which has been done already. You know, I'm not going to do anything new, and the guy that comes after me is going to do the same thing I did. I was a king. So maybe I'll look at what's the difference anyway between folly and wisdom and madness. Then I saw, and this is perceptive, that wisdom excelleth folly, as far as light excelleth darkness, that wisdom is better than foolishness and emptiness. Wisdom is better than folly, and it is. Certainly. And in all of this, this doesn't get discount for any of us that as Christian men and women, we should do the best in whatever field we're in. I think if you're a Christian salesman, you should be the best. I think if you're a Christian carpenter, you should be the best. I think you should excel in everything you do, knowing that you're that light and that witness for Christ. It's a means unto an end. It's not an end in itself. And Solomon, as he is not discounting that, he's just talking about making the pursuit of the thing itself. Making the means to the end, the pursuit in itself. And he said, I perceived, he said, that wisdom was better than folly, as far as light is better than darkness. Look at verse 14. The wise man's eyes are in his head. And the idea is he's seeing. The fool walks in darkness. He's bumbling around on this planet. And I myself perceived also that one event happens to them all. Then I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, so it happens to me. Why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this is also vanity. I'm overqualified and unemployed. And the jerk down the street makes 14 bucks an hour and he dropped out of high school, you know. He's looking around saying, you know, what is going on? I saw that wisdom's better than folly, but I looked at the fool getting buried, and I looked at the wise man getting buried, and the same thing happens to both of them. He says, 16, for there is no remembrance of the wise more than the fool, seeing that which now is in the days to come shall all be forgotten. And how dieth the wise man? He dies the same way the fool does. What a depressing guy, man. You know, smartest guy that ever lived, and this is what he's got figured out. There's no remembrance. Now, of course, for us, in Malachi chapter 3 says there's a book of remembrance written before the Lord for all of those who think about him and talk on his name, you know. There is remembrance afterward. But Solomon doesn't have that in focus. You know, it's kind of like the law of diminishing returns. When he had a little bit, and he built his first building, you know, he found some pleasure in it, and he was encouraged. It was gratification. As he built bigger buildings and bigger venues and got more money and more wise, and it was the law of diminishing returns. And the more he got, the less it meant to him. And he couldn't find anything to renew his spirit, to lift him up. Now, Paul, remember, he says his secret, and Solomon is examining everything under the sun on this plane. Paul said that he was renewed in the inner man day by day. And then he said, while we look, not at the things that are seen, but at the things that are not seen. Because the things that are seen are temporal, and the things that are not seen are eternal. And Paul said it was while we kept in focus those eternal things, though the outward man was perishing, the inward man was renewed, and he says day by day. And here's Paul the apostle. His experience was he didn't get gassed up on Sunday, and it lasted all week. He ran out of gas on Monday like the rest of us. He said he needed to be renewed day by day. And he discovered in his own existence it was by beholding those things that Abraham saw afar off, that Moses esteemed the reproach of Christ more excellent than all the riches of Egypt, And it's the very thing that Solomon doesn't have in focus here. With all the things that this world has to offer, he finds only frustration and emptiness. And that the fool dies the same way the wise man does. He goes, that's the end of both. Look at verse 17. Therefore, I hated life. Having it all, you know. You know, you get the brochures. Go on a cruise to Jamaica. You'll be happy. You see people running down the beach and, you know, hang gliding. And you go, oh, Club Med, I need it bad, you know. And, hey, believe me, Solomon has it all. And he looks around and says, I hated life. Because the work that is wrought under the sun is grievous unto me. For all is vanity, emptiness, and vexation of spirit. Emptiness and frustration is my experience. Yea, I hated all my labor. Now, again, labor 34 times. We talk about the labor. In one place, he says the guy that works, at least when he goes to bed at night, he sleeps. And the sleep of the laboring man is sweeter than mine. Solomon looked around and said, the guy I got working in my vineyard, at least he enjoys sleep. I turn around on my bed all night worrying about my investments. He said, the laboring man, at least his sleep is sweet when he begins to look at what do we have out of all our labor. I hated my labor, he says, which I had taken under the sun, because I should leave it unto the man that shall be after me. You know, he looked around and realized, my building, my vineyard, you know, and then he looks at Rehoboam and says, ay, you know what I mean? One generation comes, another generation goes. All the things I've made, I've got gray hair and wrinkles doing it all. Now I'm going to pass off the scene and leave it to the guy behind me. You know, he's got like that vending machine mentality, you know what I mean? That everybody comes up to me and knows what button to push to get what they want, you know? And you get that way sometimes. You got kids, you got a wife or your husband, you got everybody, you know, I'm the vending machine, and everybody knows what to do to get what they want out of you. And you feel like, yeah, you know, the straight life, what's it all about? Who knows, he says, whether he shall be wise. This is the man, he's leaving everything he's amassed. Who knows whether he shall be wise man or a fool? Yet shall he have to rule over all my labor, wherein I have labored and wherein I have showed myself wise under the sun. This is nothing but vanity. You know, this is the executive's nightmare. You know, a guy that works on Wall Street and ends up with his own high rise and beautiful offices and walnut desks and, you know, $1,000 paperweights and everything, and here comes the sun and, you know, and the guy looks at him and thinks, this is it, man, I'm leaving everything to him, you know. What's it all about? And here's Solomon, he looks at Rehoboam. Rehoboam squandered everything. He was a knucklehead, you know. And here's Solomon, leaves everything he's amassed to Rehoboam, and the kingdom is torn from him, and it ends up to be a disaster. Now he's looking around saying, so I hated life. I hated everything I amassed. I hated all my wealth, everything I accomplished, because I realize the wise man dies like the fool does. And when I pass off the scene, who knows whether the guy that gets everything I work so hard for is he going to squander it in 3 weeks. This is also emptiness. Therefore, I went about to cause my heart to despair of all the labor which I took under the sun. For there is a man whose labor is in wisdom, and in knowledge, and in equity, yet to a man that hath not labored therein, shall he leave it for his portion. This also is vanity and great evil. He says, you know, he says, as a man through wisdom and through knowledge and fairness and justice has amassed his wealth and come to his position in life, and then he leaves it to a guy who doesn't know anything about any of those things. For what hath man of all his labor, and of the vexation of his heart, wherein he hath labored under the sun? What in the world is it all about, and what does a man have? John D. Rockefeller, in the end of his life, was making on an average of $1 million a week profit coming into his account. And his doctors wouldn't even let him eat. In the morning, he had 1 teaspoon of coffee, 1 bite of egg, one spoonful of cereal. His stomach was so rotten and eaten up with ulcers that what was life all about to him? You know, he couldn't even enjoy his labor. He couldn't even eat and sleep like a normal person. As the laborer, you know, that was working for him was coming home from work and eating a big fat steak and kissing his wife and kids goodnight and hitting the sack and getting a sound night's sleep. And here was Rockefeller and all the vanity of life with nothing. If you study the life of Howard Hughes, you can get the book Citizen Hughes at the bookstore talking about, you know, here's a guy who sat finally in an ivory tower, owned more land in Nevada than it's legal for the United States government to own. Controlled neighborhoods. He was a bigot. He decided on zoning all over the country from his ivory tower. He was a racist. He was crazy. He was afraid of germs. He died with needles stuck in his arm. He went mad, like Nebuchadnezzar in the days of Daniel, because he wouldn't glorify the God of heaven. Therefore, his hair began to grow out in his fingernails, and he began to act like an ox. You know, he turned his back on the testimony of Daniel, and God had clearly spoken to his life, and he turned away from that. So God said he was going to give him over to be like a beast. And one day he was out walking on his veranda saying, "Isn't this beautiful? I think I'll..." Did you hear that? You know, just slowly somehow, I mean, He just degenerated into, for 7 seasons or 7 years or whatever. It says he crawled around on all fours. They kept him in a courtyard. They grew grass for him, and his fingernails curled all around, and his hair grew out like eagle's feathers, and he was a wild man and a beast. That's the way Howard Hughes died. You know, I've seen millionaires who do not have the ability to be thankful for the plate of food that's put in front of them when most of the world is starving. And I've seen families that have an old skinny chicken stuck in front of them with 6 or 7 kids, and there's just a little bit for everybody, and they're overjoyed. And only God grants to the human heart that ability. You know, I've seen other people's children who I have possessed more than they have, because they've hated them and abused them and mean to them. And I've looked in the eyes of these kids and I've laughed and teased them and just brokenheartedly wanted to embrace them and possessed more of their own offspring in some sense than they have, because God didn't give them the ability to see and appreciate what they had right in front of them. And Solomon, because he's looking at everything without... You know, there's a missing part to his equation, and that is the Lord God who made the heavens and the earth, who would provide a redeemer one day, who David's heart was always fixed upon. "My heart is fixed, O God. I lay me down, I awake, for thou sustains me." You know, "though 10,000 fall at my right," you know, that he knew no harm would come to him. You know, "the heavens declare the glory of the Lord, and the firmament is his handiwork. And the stars, night unto night, they utter a speech that's heard in every language." You know, what a remarkable man. As he ran through the hills like a partridge, he said, on the mountains, being chased with nowhere to lay his head, nowhere to live. And what a perspective as he looked up at the stars at night. He thought, if a sword goes through my throat while I sleep tonight, Lord, I'll wake up and in thy presence is fullness of joy. And Solomon doesn't have that in his equation at all. Now, verse 24, kind of the light flashes as we end here on his perspective, as he says this: "There is nothing better," he says, "for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that he should make his soul enjoy the good of his labor." Now, this is just good, wholesome stuff. A hardworking man to eat and to sleep, to drink, to enjoy the fruit of his labor, he says. "And this also I saw, that it is from the hand of God." And God alone gives the ability to enjoy these things. He says, "I realized that as I looked at it." "For who can eat, or who else can hasten thereunto more than I?" Who knows more? Who could do this more than me, is what he's saying. And the Amplified Bible adds, apart from him. I think the NIV here says, for without him, who can eat and find enjoyment? And I think the idea here in the language is, what he's saying is, he says, I realize from the hand of God that what better thing is there really for a man who works and labors in this world to eat and to drink and enjoy the fruit of his labor and get a decent night's sleep? That these things, at least in and of themselves, they're good. Is this what they're all there is to life? There's nothing wrong with that, he said, and I realize that that was from the hand of God. But there's more than that. You know, it's amazing. There is more than that. You ever get around a group of Christians that you're good friends with, and or if you go out to dinner with them, you know what I mean? And it doesn't take long before you're laughing and tears are running down your cheek and you're carrying on and somebody's putting food on their head, or, you know, and you think, man, this is without drugs, it's without alcohol. I mean, Christian fellowship can really get crazy and full of joy. And there's nothing wrong with that. God gives us the ability to laugh and to carry on, to enjoy one another. And it's so remarkable, you know, that we can party without those things, you know. The joy of the Lord with friendship and sincerity, and be disarmed and make ourselves vulnerable, to laugh and to carry on and to be crazy. You know, a spirit of lunacy comes in the camp around here once in a while. And, you know, I appreciate it in many ways. What precious things that God has given to us. And he sees a bit of that here. For God giveth to a man that is good in his sight wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner he gives travail. And he makes an interesting point. To gather and to heap up, that the sinner may give to him that is good before God. This also, he says, though, is emptiness and frustration. He says there's also, not only does the wise man labor and do all this stuff and then die and leave it to a fool, he says sometimes the situation's opposite, where you see the sinner and the evil man who schemes his way through this world and amasses his millions. We see God then handing that off to the believer, to the man who pleases him. So, you know, it's remarkable as he goes, you know, as I read through this, you can understand why people commit suicide, in a sense, because this when this is their perspective, and they've really measured out life, you know. People, you know, the suicide rate in L.A. is much higher than it is here, because we hear about sunny Southern California. What a joke that is. You know, the sun only gets through a few days a year with the smog. But people hear about it and they think, man, if I was there, I'd be happy. And people move to L.A. and you can't even breathe, you know. You can't even see the guy that's stabbing you there. And then they think it isn't here. And the highest rate of suicide in the United States is in Hawaii, because people think, you know, I haven't gone all the way, you know. Another 5 hours on the plane is where paradise really is, and they think they're going to come in, and a little guy's going to go, boss, the plane, you know, and they're going to come down, and they're going to find life's answer. And in Hawaii is the highest rate of suicide in the country, because once you've reached paradise and you're still miserable, where else is there to go then? You know, New Jersey? I mean, come on. You know. And I'll tell you something, that's why the leading cause of death in the United States is among teenagers. See, when I was 13 years old, 1963, I was in the Boy Scouts. I was trying to get an Eagle badge. When a lot of kids are 13 now, they've already tried drugs. They've already tried alcohol. There's kids that are 13 years old. They're making $1,000 a day carrying drugs for drug pushers, because they're juveniles and they get out again. And how are we going to expect that kid to graduate from high school and work for $10 an hour, when he used to make $1,000 a day when he was 8? You see? And they've tried everything that Solomon has tried by the time they're 13, and they've looked around the way Solomon has, and they said, what is it? What's the purpose in it all? I've tried sex. I've tried drugs. I've tried alcohol. I've indulged my flesh. I've made money. I'm 14 years old. They're building nuclear bombs. One generation goes, another generation is coming. Amazing to be that young and know that drunkenness is folly, that drugs is not the answer, that sex, that these things only, you know, you numb your brain for one night, and it makes your problems go away for 2 hours, but you got to come back to reality again. Or you indulge your flesh, you know what I mean, for a half an hour, and then the next day it's there in your face again, not satisfied. Once again, the eyes never filled with seeing. Or you get the bottle and you drown your brain in alcohol and burn all your nerve endings off, and you're okay for one night, and the next day you wake up with a hangover again. I'll never drink again as long as I live. Where's the raw eggs? Where's the tomato juice? You know, and the next night you're out doing the same thing again. And Jesus said, you know, if you come to me, I will give you water to drink and you'll never thirst again. The water you drink of, the water we drink of, the water we drank of when we were in the world, we only wanted more the next weekend or the next night. We only had to have it again, and every time we had it 1,000 times, it never satisfied. You know, and it's the same thing Solomon's going through, and it's the same thing teenagers go through. And I can see as I read through this, because Solomon's not messing around. You know, this is really the perspective of life apart from Christ without any exaggerations. I mean, really think of it. 1,000 women. Come on, guys, think of that. I mean, I'm not tempting you. I'm just saying, think of what he's saying. 1,000 women. All of the buildings, summer places in the mountains, trout ponds, the best beer and wine in the world, servants, 1957 chariots, everything, kids, 700 wives. How many kids did he have? No wonder he needed servants. And there was nothing. You know? And you can really see when you read through this where the natural heart and that where the natural mind are even today, especially amongst our younger generation. And I think, man, we have got the answer. There's no hope in any of this that Solomon's saying, you know. And I think, well, gee, I'm 41. How the heck am I going to reach these kids? I mean, you know, like Solomon say, one generation comes and another generation passes away. I hear kids today say, who's George Harrison? I feel like, who's George Harrison? You know, wake up, kid. You know what I mean? You know, who are the Beatles? You know, and then you realize, my God, it's happening to me. I've become an old fogey. You know, I don't know, you know, even know the names of the bands they're listening to. But I have the message. I have what they want. I know what fills the empty spot. I know the person that comes into our life, whether we're rich or poor, sick or healthy, that makes all the difference in the world. Whether we're facing death or whether we're facing life, he's the companion that makes all the difference. And I think, well, we've got that right now for a lost world. That's why Jesus said, You know, Solomon was the wisest man that ever lived, and in his depression did not have what you possessed this evening. John the Baptist was the greatest prophet that ever lived, Jesus said, and he didn't have the picture clear. Jesus said, yet he who is least in the kingdom is greater than him. And I think we've got the answer for a lost world. And Jesus said, you alone are the light of the world. You alone are the salt of the earth. And sometimes I look around and I think, you know, I can really see this perspective amongst earthly people, worldly people, trying all these things to fill the empty place. And I think what we have is so real and so valuable. You know, Jesus Christ, why aren't there more open hearts? And why aren't people more readily getting saved and accepting? And I think, you know, maybe we're just coming to that place where the cold are getting cold and the hot are getting hot and there's no more lukewarm left in the middle. You know, there's like, then it's time for the church to be out of here. When we've battered against, you know, the bastion of humanity, when we've battered against this huge sea of humanity to the point where there's no more fish to be caught, then it's time for us not to be here. There's no more purpose. But maybe God's going to open a whole generation's eyes once again before we're out. He opened our eyes, you know. We come through the generation with the Beatles and LSD and spending all our money on drugs and stuff. And I was there, and Christ made the difference. And I'm hoping that the generation that's coming up behind us, our generation's passing away, the one ahead of us is checking out right now. And here we are kind of in the middle, and there's another one coming up behind us. Maybe if we pray, you know, I don't know. It's not something you can sweat up, but maybe we'll see God pour out His Spirit again and see, hopefully, an ingathering here on the East Coast before it's all over. Because the book of Ecclesiastes is going to tell us what the average guy on the street that you work with, don't be mad at him tomorrow morning you go to work and he's miserable. This is why. Say, I read about you last night. That'll make him real happy. Please, 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 you know, give me a day. We need to get started here. And you have the answer that guy's looking for. He doesn't know it. But maybe we'll see it. Maybe we'll see it again.